Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel. The all-new Opel Mokka. With a new visor front face and pure panel interior, this is Opel.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
And it's time now for our weekly gathering. We're going to take a look at the stories making the news this week. I'm joined by Michael Clifford, special correspondent with the Irish Examiner, Owen O'Brien, Sinn Féin spokesman on housing and TD for Dublin Midwest. Fine Gael Senator Regina Doherty is here too. You're all very welcome. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Let's go back to earlier in the week when we had the former Minister for Housing here, Owen Murphy. He was resigning, not just from the Dáil, but resigning from politics, leaving as a TD, prompting a by-election. And he told me about some of his regrets. Let's have a listen.
If I think back to some of the experiences that I had, you know, in my first week in the role, I met a woman who works in early learning, and she was talking about children presenting to her who didn't have developed motor neuron skills because they didn't have crawl space in their hotel rooms. And my immediate reaction was, not on my watch. We're going to fix this. And I didn't, you know, and I regret that.
Okay, so he has some regrets. He's quite open about that. But Regina, you fought to win a seat in that election. There's one of your colleagues who had one and is walking away. Is that hard to see?
Well, it's hard to lose him on a personal level, first of all, because the both of us would have got elected to the council at the same time and then to the Dáil at the same time. So we've been pals, friends for many years. And so on that level, and you know, the politics is an interesting business and there isn't a huge amount of friendships that are sustained. So I will miss him as a pal. But obviously we'll keep in contact with him. But he is an immensely talented fella. And whether, you know, whether you agree that whether policies happened fast enough for people's, you know, either needs or expectations, we can certainly have a conversation about that. He's an incredibly hardworking fella. He's well-liked, I think, across all parties, notwithstanding some of the personalised nonsense that would have gone over the last couple of years. He's just an inherently a decent fella. And so, of course, I think politics will miss him more than anything else. But yeah, well, Owen O'Brien, not always appreciated, to be honest with you.
Yourself and Owen Murphy went toe-to-toe so many times. I mean, your political adversaries is a polite way of putting it. But he mentioned you and on Tuesday. He said that you often agreed on areas, particularly at committee level when you were working through issues. How would you characterise and describe your relationship with him?
Well, I think in fairness, the relationship was one based on policies. So when we had disagreements, and there were far more disagreements than there were areas of agreement, it was on the policies. Look, he inherited, in my view, a deeply flawed housing policy of rebuilding Ireland. He didn't do anything significant to change course of that policy. In fact, some of the decisions that he made, I think, made it worse. And I think his problem is that if you just look at all the metrics, number of people in homeless accommodation, house prices, rental prices, issues around planning and things like co-living, things were worse at the end of his tenure as minister than they were at the start. Now, all of those problems, in my view, started much earlier, and the responsibility is not just his. But a minister has to take responsibility for their failings. And you heard a little bit of that in the interview. What I also think, though, is very significant is that what his resignation shows, and maybe the one thing I disagree with him with, is I do think his housing policy failures played a central role in the ending of his political career. I think that's a lesson for anybody who occupies the Custom House.
He asked not to be on the front line in the next government after the last election. That's his stance on it, that he had that conversation with Leo Varadkar. I think he said even before the election.
He did, yeah.
But the point I was going to make is this, and again, it's a lesson for the current incumbent and any future housing minister. See, most people out there actually think housing can be fixed. They believe that things can be done better. And I think any politician who takes on that huge responsibility of trying to start to slowly undo the damage of years of bad housing policy, I think will be judged very, very harshly by the public if they don't move things in the right direction. So, look, I wish Owen the best. Look, he's decided to move on. But we should not ignore the fact that all of the housing policies that he pursued and all of the promises he made to improve things didn't work. And that's a lesson to ensure whoever now is in the Customs House, we have Dara O'Brien and we don't know how long he's going to be there. We need a radical change in housing policy to tackle the growing social and affordable housing crisis that hasn't been provided to date. And therefore, you know, we need new policies and a new direction.
Right. Mick Clifford is with us. You're not in the room with us, Mick, but you're in the building somewhere sitting in front of a microphone. I just want to talk to you about the Dublin-Bay South constituency and the by-election, because usually these by-elections will happen later in a Dáil term. The government parties get a bit of a drubbing. This is slightly different. What would you expect to see here? Do you think Fine Gael can hold that seat?
I think in particular if Kate O'Connell were to run, I think it's very likely. Even if she doesn't, I'd say they'd have a very good chance. It'll be interesting, though. It, to some extent, it'll be a barometer of where we are politically, but you have to put that in the context that this is really a Fine Gael constituency primarily, so you would expect them to win it. The other interesting aspect, too, on Murphy's resignation, Claire, is the fact of somebody going so young and having spent, I think it is, 10 years in the Dáil, another two on local authority before that. You know, there's a case to be made that it's a good idea from this point of view. The shorter term people have in politics, the greater urgency they would have, the better chance they have of making an impact. Okay, it didn't work out for Owen Murphy. But if you look in other areas, even like the private sector, it's well accepted that, you know, there's 10 years max that you can be at your optimum when you're in a high-pressure job. And to a large extent, if you're anywhere near government or outside of government attempting to change things, beyond that, things can get jaded.
And there's an idea now. There's an idea. The clock is ticking on us all in this room. Anyway, what do you think, Regina? Time limit?
Yeah, make us a point. I mean, if you have a focus and an end game and you know you only have a certain amount of time to achieve something, but then there would have to be a step change in the administration, because it's not necessarily the ministers that delay things being implemented. It's the fact that it takes so long to get legislation drafted, then to get it appraised, then to get it through, then to, once you establish the legislation and the body to organise whatever it is you're trying to do, then that takes years. All of that takes far too long. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I'll disagree with Owen is that I don't think it's fair to call Owen's three-year tenure as Minister for Housing an abject failure. He started and took over an industry that was building 5,000 houses, and when he, you know, handed it over, it was building 20,000 houses. And so not everything went right, and he's admitted that himself, but I don't think it's fair to call it an abject failure. I think when your focus is on trying to achieve something, you literally work 15, 18 hours a day. And, you know, I'm sure Owen will have his, this Owen here beside me, will have his opportunity at some point in the future. The most frustrating thing is the speed at which the system will work with you.
You predicting a Sinn Féin general election win there?
No, look, come here. Everybody's going to fight this election to try and win it. We're all, like, that's the competitive animals that we are, and that's great. And obviously, I hope we have a fantastic candidate and we'll all go out knocking on the doors, if we're allowed knocking the doors, you know.
But who should it be for Fine Gael?
Whoever the members deem that has the best chance to win.
So Kate O'Connell damaged her relationship with Leo Varadkar so much that she could not be the candidate.
Well, no, because it won't be Leo's choice. So not to be disrespectful to my party leader, at the end of the day, we have a lovely system and it works lots of times, and sometimes it works against you. Mm-hmm. It's our members that will pick who they decide
should
will run
for us. Should it be Kate O'Connell, do you think?
Well, you see, I'd love to see Kate have an opportunity to win her seat back, but I'm sure there are other people in the constituency who'd love to see their time or their opportunity. That selection convention will be one to watch. It'll be very interesting.
What are Sinn Féin going to do here in Dublin Bay South?
Well, we'll not only pick the best possible candidate, but we'll fight to win the seat. I don't agree that it's a Fine Gael constituency. They took, 25-26% of the vote last time round. They would expect to increase that on the basis of the poll numbers. Mm-hmm. But by-elections are interesting things. And of course, I was director of elections in the last by-election where everybody predicted Fine Gael to win a seat, and Sinn Féin took it with my colleague Mark Ward. This is an interesting constituency. It has a lot of younger people. It has a lot of renters. It has a lot of people on decent incomes who can't afford to buy. It has a lot of people who voted for the Green Party but might be concerned with some aspects of the implementation of the Green agenda. And therefore, given that by-elections are generally different to general elections, they're often a kind of a referendum on how the government is doing. And given that we probably will have this by-election as we're more advanced on our exit out of COVID, I think it's going to be about housing, it's going to be about health, it's going to be about childcare. And I think, therefore, the strongest anti-government candidate is going to have a really strong chance to take this seat.
And your colleague, Lynn Boyle, and also your partner, has been mentioned in relation to this.
Lots of people have been mentioned, and I won't have any part to play in the selection. That'll be done both by the local constituency organisation and the party centrally. What I will be doing is I will be doing everything I can in my power, particularly in terms of my position as spokesperson on housing, to convince as many people in that constituency is that they want a change of direction in housing policy. Don't elect another Owen Murphy. Elect somebody who's committed to a new agenda to tackle the social and affordable housing crisis that's out there.
It could be Lynn Boylan.
It could be any member of the party of good standing who gets the selection convention votes of the members.
Claire, just one quick postscript to Owen Murphy. It should be remembered too that he went in there after Leo Varadkar became leader. Simon Coveney had been Minister for Housing had shown some passion and some application to the job. Yet he left it at that time and Murphy went in there as his first ministry, which personally, I think is the toughest one that's there at the moment. And it's just a bit of a contrast. And I was no fan of Mary Harney's politics, but when she went in as Minister for Health, it was to fix it. They had a chance there with Simon Coveney to stay where he was, and that didn't happen.
What are you saying?
I'm saying you have to take that into the context of how Owen Murphy performed as a minister thereafter. There was something of a poison chalice about it. It was a big job, but it was also a really tough job for a first one. And there was already a programme in there, whether or not you agreed with it, and yet somebody new had to come in and take over from Simon Coveney.
All right. I want to ask you about the reopening plans, which everybody is talking about and focused on today, Mick. But it's just interesting, the dynamic here, because if this goes wrong, and you know every single one of us hopes that it doesn't, but because NPHET have given their permission and said this is the way to go, talking to Stephen Donnelly earlier, he didn't give any hint that there was any push and pull between government and NPHET. If this goes wrong, this is at NPHET's door, isn't it?
It is, but you could well say that. The technical sense, I think, as far as the public are concerned, it'll still be at the government's door, and it'll be viewed as a continuation of the mistakes that were made in at Christmas. That may not be fair. It may not be a reflection of the facts, but I suspect at this stage that's most likely the way people will view it one way or the other, should things not go right. It is a certain gamble, but to be honest with you, I think they had no choice because people had gone to the limit. It has been said, and it is true, it was the public that have got us to this point where we are. But I think there was very little more that people were prepared to do. It was already fraying. And whereas it is a gamble on the government's part, I think there was really very little choice once they had any kind of an imprimatur from NPHET.
OK, didn't Sinn Féin fully support these reopening measures now?
Yeah, so we've been saying, you know, right from the end of last year that we want to see the government follow the public health advice. Everything that I'm hearing both from NPHET and the government is that's what's happening. That this reopening plan, while I think has given great hope to people, it's also setting out a cautious roadmap to reopen society, reopen the economy, and it is based on that public health advice. Two things I would say, however. The first thing is given that the public have done the heavy lifting, and we all know because we're talking to people in our constituencies how this lockdown has been much harder than the others, government needs to do its job, which is, in the first instance, get the vaccination programme right, get contact testing and tracing right. Obviously, the opposition have to play the constructive role that I think we have been playing in recent months. And also the public, I think, have to be cautious as we go through this. It is important to remember, however, that if all goes well as we move throughout the summer, there'll be about 40% of people who still can't go back to work because there will still be restrictions in sectors of the economy that aren't allowed to go back to work. So what government also needs to ensure is all those people get the support and get the certainty to take them through to the point at which they can get back to work themselves.
But hasn't the government given assurances, Regina, that there won't be a cliff edge when it comes to those supports?
And there won't. I don't think it's just not sustainable. What we need to do is to support businesses to reopen, and that will mean the likes of the continuation of the CRSS, but also the wage supports, because businesses that will be lucky enough to reopen in the next couple of weeks certainly won't have the footfall that you would expect them to have to be able to stand on their own two feet. But we also, like, I agree with Mick, if things go really, really well, the government might get, you know, the praise for it. If things don't go well in the next couple of weeks, it certainly won't be NPHET that we'll be looking to phone or to give out about. But I have no doubt that if numbers do rise, that NPHET will absolutely not be shy about saying what they would give the advice. And then obviously then we'd have to take adherence of that advice. We're going to now move. Obviously, people are going to be happy in the next couple of weeks if the rain ever stops and we can actually enjoy that outdoor, right? And it gets a bit warmer. And I hope we do. And I hope people start to actually see some liberty and obviously then some freedoms reinstored because of the vaccine programme. But then we're going to get back to politics as normal. And all of the fallout that we haven't really started talking about of the last 14 months is going to have to be dealt with. And it isn't just about businesses getting back on their feet. We have a huge amount of businesses tell us that their staff are not returning to work because they don't want to, because either they're working in the black market or they're not even here anymore. They've returned home maybe to their own European countries where they originally came from. We have the story this morning of 4,500 children who haven't presented back to school in the last couple of weeks. And I've one of them at home who is suffering from major anxiety because of the last 12 months. She's our baby in the household. These are issues that are really affecting people. And I know this morning, and I don't mean to be dismissive, One of the things that you didn't list, I don't think, this morning was dancing. I have a good friend of mine whose children dance, and we always leave them, you know, out of lists because it's indoors. There are a whole load of things that we will want back.
We did get some messages on that as well. I mean, lots of people missing lots of activities that haven't been mentioned in the reopening plan. I'm sure, well, hopefully we'll get some clarity on those.
Yeah, I do hope so, because I think it's as important for us to list them off and to tell people where they are in the reopening plan, to give them the continuation of hope that the Taoiseach gave yesterday. But there are some real problems ahead, and I think we can't be rose-tinted about them. We have to address them and to put place...
Yeah, but not least of those, we will have economic questions to face that are really, really difficult. You know, I mean, we as a country can't continue to pay these supports forever. I'm sure, Eoin O'Brien, you would concede that too. It's just not possible. Well, it's not mathematically possible.
Nobody's proposing to continue supports forever, but pandemic support should remain for the course of the pandemic. And government will face two choices. They can either follow the path that we're seeing, for example, in the US and Biden, which is to stimulate our way out of the economy as the pandemic starts to recede. That's going to require investment, and there are plenty of areas of investment that are required. And we've talked about housing, for example. You know, our hospital waiting lists will be twice what they'll be coming out of COVID as they were going into COVID. There's a whole range of mental health support that were badly provided for pre-COVID. And as Regina has absolutely rightly said, the impact of COVID has meant there's going to be need more there. But even things like the summer voucher scheme, right? You know, both in the US and in the North, they're saying, well, can we stimulate the economy with some sensible supports? Whereas government here is saying, no, they're not going to do that compared to last year. So this doesn't have to be about austerity and cutbacks and reducing the income of workers who are temporarily laid off. Smart strategic investment can ensure we stimulate our way out and ensure people's incomes are protected, and vital public services that have been poorly provided for decades can also be part of that. We cannot go back to business as usual as it was before COVID-19, and we've an opportunity to make some very, very significant changes, and the money is there for that.
I want to talk about the vaccination rollout now, Mick. I don't know about you, but I feel as though we're getting tied up in knots with the vaccination, because the over 50s are getting the Johnson & Johnson, but we don't have enough of the Johnson & Johnson. We have the other vaccines, so we may start vaccinating the younger cohort, and the over 50s will have to wait until later in the summer for their Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Is that what you understand?
I more or less, like, I'm being in that cohort myself, Claire. it makes me more nervous even, you know. But it is very awkward. And I suppose, look, their hands are tied to an extent in terms of the recommendations that are there for the use of the particular vaccines. Whether or not those recommendations are required, whether they're not the result of an abundance of caution, and whether we could be looser with them, we'll just have to wait and see. But from the beginning, I've been of the opinion that the whole vaccine rollout should not have been something handed over to the Department of Health and HSE. It was a logistics operation. And if it had been done on that basis, you'd have to hope that it would be
done.
Who
would do it then, if not the Department of Health?
Well, I think it's a thing you could contract out to a logistics company, a serious logistics company.
Then you're privatising it, and that would cause more problems.
Perhaps in some ways, or maybe you're just contracting it. Perhaps it would, but I mean, I'm just saying, I'm talking about literally the business of getting this stuff into people's arms in the quickest way possible. That's what we're about. And so far, now, having said all that, you know, there have been major hiccups near the start. It seems to be picking up pace. I think there's no way we're going to reach the alleged 80% target by the end of June. But if we're up 60, 70%, I think people will be relatively happy with that if we can keep ramping it up to that level.
Do you think people will be happy with 60 or 70%? I really don't, because the 82% is repeated ad nauseum now at this stage. And it's just, if we're not going to reach it, it's not fair to keep repeating it.
I agree with you, but I reckon there would be a level of herd immunity by that stage that people would accept it. Maybe not, but I think the specific targets, I know they do keep repeating it, and therefore giving hostages to fortune, but I just wonder, even if it's within the neighbourhood of that, I think people will be relatively happy.
Okay.
Getting to the neighbourhood of that is still going to be a major issue.
Yeah, and Regina, do you agree that if you get close to 82%, it'll be okay? People will accept
that? So, Camille, the target is there on the basis of that's what's going to allow us to be comfortable with making further decisions with regard to returning people to their workplaces and stuff like that, and educational campuses. I think the bigger concern is going to be that when we get to younger age categories, that they won't want to take it up. And so, you know, that when any politician is talking to you about the 82%, they say of adults who want to avail of the vaccine. I think we're going to get to a situation later on in the summer, and we need to be prepared for it and make sure that we have, you know, a reverse campaign to encourage people to do so. I think some of our younger cohorts, based on the pollings for the last couple of weeks, don't see the need. And OK, they've left level five long before us older people have. We haven't yet, but I think we need to be aware of that. But I don't think it's fair from, and I don't mean to be disrespectful to Mick, I think the HSE, Brian McRae, have done a wonderful job, notwithstanding the recalibration because of the supply issue of getting the jabs into people's arms over the last couple of months. As soon as they had the jabs in, or the vaccine in the country, within 48 hours, they had it in people's arms. And so I think they've done a good job. That will accelerate over the coming weeks.
As you're talking there, I'm thinking about the people who are housebound, many of whom still haven't been vaccinated, which is extraordinary, really, that has happened.
Yeah, and look, what most people want is they just want clarity and they want a clarity of message. And I'm sure it's the same for Regina, but I'm getting contacted by lots of people in my constituency who are, say, in group three and group four. So they're either the over 70s or they're the people under 70 with high-risk medical conditions. And their problem is not that they want vaccinated today, although they prefer that, but that nobody can tell them a reasonable time frame within which that's going to happen. And that's causing a lot of confusion because their friends on another part of the town or the city have already been vaccinated and they think they're going to get left behind. So the one thing I would urge both the government and the HSE to improve in this is just the clarity of the messaging and communication and the information for people, particularly vulnerable people. Obviously, everybody needs to do everything they can to get the supply, right? But there are some factors there government can't control. But what the government and the HSE can control is to give people that certainty. And I think if they did that, then as we move over these next number of weeks, if there are changes, for example, if there are reductions in projected supply, so long as government is upfront and gives people that clarity, I think people can work with it. What we do need is we need to get as close to that 80% by that deadline. And we need to take people with us. So I think communication is key in all of this.
Just before we finish, Edwin Poots. Who can work with Edwin Poots if he becomes the leader of the DUP? Could Fine Gael work with him? I mean, just looking at some of his previous comments, my view is that the Earth is a young Earth around 4000 BC. Are you telling me that all this evolution took place over billions of years and yet it's only recently that man actually learned to write? What do you think, Regina?
We certainly have some interesting characters in Irish politics. But whoever is the successful applicant and the outcome of that competition, we will all have to work with them. Because if we want a shared Ireland in whatever form that that's going to be in the months and years ahead, well, then we all have to sit around the table and find the best solution for every citizen on the island of Ireland.
I'm sure you'd agree that you have to be pragmatic, Ona Brin, and I'm rushing along here because we're just almost out of time. Arlene Foster, though, gone, and we hear today, not just from her role as leader, but also from the DUP altogether.
And look, as somebody who has direct experience of working with many of the unionists who share those views from my time at Belfast City Council, I understand the challenge involved. But look, the leader of the DUP is a matter for the DUP. Whoever is elected, the Good Friday Agreement is still the Good Friday Agreement. The institutional framework and the agreements that have been reached by both governments and all parties up until this point are still there and still have to be honoured. We will engage constructively, openly and honestly with whoever is the leader. We want a willing partner. And that's not just with the DUP, that's with the other parties. So that's the approach we'll take. But a willing partner has to be willing. And therefore, the DUP, whoever they elect, also have to understand that that means they need to engage and work with all of the other parties in the Assembly, as well as the government in the South and Westminster.
We've got to leave it there. Ona Brin, Mick Clifford and Regina Doherty, thank you very much indeed for joining us.